Hi, this is Steve Poore, and you're listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Our guest today is Zach DiMiola. Zach is the Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Law School Admission Council. LSAC is a not-for-profit organization with a goal of promoting access, equity, and fairness in law school admission and supporting learning journeys from pre-law through practice. A former corporate litigation attorney, Zach left practice after several years to join the Institute for the Advancement of American Legal System, IALS. There he focused on innovation in legal education and the legal profession. Today, at LSAC, Zach supports a range of initiatives, working with cross-functional teams to design and implement specific programs, learning outcomes, and standards-based assessments in the organization's educational programs. Additionally, he co-founded Access to Justice Ventures with Natalie Ann Knowlton. Natalie is a past guest on the podcast. In our wide-ranging discussion, Zach talks about the mission of LSAC, reconsidering the way we test new lawyers, and professional identity formation. We also had an interesting conversation about how clerking at the Arkansas Supreme Court following his evacuation from Tulane Law School in New Orleans because of Katrina shaped his career. Thanks to Zach for the time spent talking to us, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for listening. Zach, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I look forward to the conversation.
Likewise.
You've had a very interesting career. Rather than starting at the beginning and working up to today, let's start with today and work backwards a little bit. But let's start by talking a little bit about what you're currently doing. You're currently Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Law School Admission Council.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a mouthful. What does that mean?
A few things, in fact. So there are a couple things that I do at LSAC. The first is that I am involved in sort of our strategic initiatives, and that is spotting opportunities for LSAC to support law schools and to support students that are entering into law school and students that are having their first year in law school, for instance. So, I mean, our mission really is oriented to get the best possible opportunities and experiences for students. We really want to bring qualified people into the profession. And part of that is also, you know, bring diversity, equity, and inclusion into the profession, which is something the profession can really use some help with. So spotting those opportunities is one thing, and then developing them is another. Part of spotting those opportunities is supervising our research within LSAC. We have a lot of data on students and admissions, and it can inform decisions, I think, for education and for the profession. And then also, I help to develop educational content. So we have a platform at LSAC called Law Hub, and Law Hub is a place where students can go for help in admissions, but also help in generally in education, legal education, academic skills, and those sorts of things.
How have you seen, you've been there now, well, year and a half, 2 years. What interesting trend lines does your research show in terms of markers for success, the characteristics that you're looking for people going into law school? I know that's a broad question.
Well, actually, I mean, but it does relate. It relates back to my career trajectory too, because before joining LSAC, I was the director of legal education and the profession at IALS, which is the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. And one of the big projects there was research that we called Foundations for Practice, identifying specifically what lawyers would need right out of law school. So, marrying that experience with what I do in LSAC, I am constantly looking for opportunities to provide students to really develop, right, the abilities that they'll need to succeed in law school and then eventually succeed in practice. So a couple of things that we're seeing from the data, interestingly, is I think very much related to some of the bigger trends we see in legal education. And that is, for instance, this isn't necessarily unique to this generation of law students, but law students really truly want to see themselves in practice. They want to see that the work that they do has some impact for clients and for society. And I think that relates to there's a trend right now, an emphasis on more skills-based education that the profession is looking for law students to graduate with more developed skills, not just knowledge on how to practice law. I think students are hungry for that too. And there's a whole variety of different things that feed into their ability to develop those skills. Characteristics and competencies that we identified in Foundations for Practice but things that also, I think, support overall lifelong learner excellence that I think any good lawyer would recognize. So those are things like diligence and resilience, and I think open-mindedness, like a sort of a growth mindset, and all the components that go into that. That's important, I think, for getting into law school, for doing well in law school, and also doing well as a lawyer.
How has the impact of technology, and particularly generative AI, I mean, we're sort of past the initial panic phase, I think, but we're now into trying to sort through, what does it mean? What does it mean for lawyers? You talk about skills training. Some of the skills you're talking about, though, are more human skills as opposed to technical skills. Are those human skills likely to become more important for lawyers?
I think so. And I think that actually supports some of the trend that we're seeing. And this corresponds to other trends in the profession and I think in the legal system at large. And that is, there are links, I think, to the access to justice issues. When we talk about what skills lawyers really need, we're also talking about we start to understand what people who may not need to be fully lawyers but could help people with legal problems need to be proficient in. And what are the things that we can automate? What are the things that we may not necessarily need full service legal training or licensing? So the closer you get to binary decisions of X versus Y, I think the closer you get to technological solutions that can be applied without a whole lot of risk to the outcome for someone with a legal problem. And I think things like AI, generative AI, and these trends that we're seeing in technology, I think there are two major outcomes that I would expect. First is a deeper emphasis on the less tangible, more social, maybe even non-cognitive, we call them non-cognitive skills. Those are things like emotional intelligence, empathy, for instance, but they're also things like practical judgment, understanding how to make judgment calls in context. And I think that is where lawyers can practice at the height of their license. So I think technology will push us further towards those trends and in those directions. I think that's a good thing for lawyers. I think it's a good thing for people with legal problems too.
How do you look for those skills in people in terms of testing or looking or getting people to be self-aware enough to go, these are the characteristics that are going to make me successful in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole variety of ways to do this. If you're trying to do assessment on these skills, there are things like situational judgment tests, situational awareness tests, right, where you set up scenarios and have people encounter those scenarios and make certain judgment calls or make choices. And usually the option of choices, there's no clear right answer, but a different choice would reflect a different set of judgment. American medical schools actually have this in their admissions tests now. These sort of sophisticated abilities of assessing those non-cognitive skills. We don't have that in legal education quite yet, but maybe we will in the future. In terms of instruction, right, at the classroom level, I think this is where practicum matters, right? I think that the application of those decisions in context are how you get to gauge where you fall in the development of those abilities and then how to improve them. And this is, we've seen this in legal education in clinics, in externships. That's where we see practicum, the ability to, in real time or in real context, exercise choices, learn from those choices, get coaching and feedback, and then improve them. I think that's really something we've been lacking in traditional legal education. And I think a lot of lawyers in practice feel that, right? When the students graduate and they're not practice ready, you know, whatever that may mean, I think a lot of it reflects a lack of emphasis on the ability for students to really apply their knowledge in practice.
Do you see any trends or resistance or an embracing of the practicum side of the equation? I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently, again, particularly with generative AI, about the emphasis on the human skills as opposed to the doctrinal teaching. And I think there's a resistance in law schools to change their methodology. There's resistance to the legal profession to change as a general proposition. I don't know why I hold law professors out as being any different.
Well, I do think it's, I mean, some of that resistance is developed in law school. I think it starts in law school. And let's not forget that the model for legal education we have is something we inherited from the 19th century, late 19th century. And what we see there is this high emphasis, those high cognitive analytical skills, right? How to think like a lawyer. We do that really, really, really well. But what we don't understand and what that model didn't prepare us for was that that's not the whole equation. everything we know from foundations to practice, which was my study, the study I carried on from my predecessor, Ali Gerkman at Iles, to there's another study called the Schultz-Zedek, lawyer effectiveness factors, where they studied a whole variety of legal situations, interviewed lawyers and clients to isolate those skills that really are important to practice. We know concretely what it is that lawyers need to be successful in practice, to be effective for their clients. Are we teaching to those things? And the answer to that is no, because we created a model for education that predated all of this evidence and all this other assessment we were able to do later in later years. Also predated things like, I don't know, the Watergate scandal, which for that, we didn't actually teach ethics, not in any required formal way or professional responsibility. So education has had to react to the circumstances around us in society, but it has done so slowly, and it hasn't really ever truly transformed the framework. Instead, we've been playing within the framework that we inherited. That emphasis on thinking like a lawyer, it's not that that isn't important, it's that it's not the only thing. And law schools are having a tough time understanding how to integrate these other things to really transform legal education. Faculty famously are sort of opposed to this because the traditional view is that they teach the high cognitive, the doctrine. These are the doctrinal courses. We all have this in law school in our first year. And that all originates from this 19th century way of thinking, of compartmentalizing, right? And really using your logic to get at these patterns and understanding these patterns. The problem with that in the modern context is that it does not contextualize the thinking sufficiently enough to prepare lawyers to be effective in society. And there are a lot of other consequences that come with extracting the logic from the context of the problem. I think you can attach some of that to our current access to justice crisis. You can attach some of that to the lack of diversity or even the consideration of diversity traditionally within the legal system, and the lack of understanding in terms of sort of, you know, history and how it plays its role in the development of these problems and the solutions here. So we are still stuck in this structure that I think overemphasizes that logic extracted from context. I think if we could contextualize it, we could really see some results, and we might end up being a little less risk averse when it comes to innovation too, because we would understand how to mitigate that, how to control that, and how to direct it and guide it. That's a long answer, but there is hope, right? I think that access to justice, technology, these are additional social forces that I think do speed up the necessity of the academy to adapt and react. And the more the profession can pay attention to this, the more they can also help with those dynamics and bring education up to where it needs to be in the modern world.
Do you see the possibility of pressure coming from the customers of law schools, the students coming in and the employers who are hiring out? There's always been sort of this disconnect between what law firms or private employers say they're looking for and what law schools are generating. I don't know how much disconnect there actually has been, but do you see these also being additional pressures that might drive change?
Yeah, potentially. From the law student perspective, there's a massive financial problem. Legal education, the way it's developing, is unsustainable. And so if the consumer of legal education is the law student, I think there are serious questions about the value proposition of law school when we're asking these students to take on so much debt and they're unsure of what their employment possibilities are on the back end. If the federal government, for instance, were to revise the way it does student loans in any significant way, I think it would immediately force changes on the system and the structure. And that might happen if these students, the future lawyers and future professionals, have a stronger voice and really, really are more and more sensitive to those problems. So that's one thing. In the profession, it's a yes and no question. I mean, I hear from lawyers a lot that they want, that being practice ready, it's a vague term, but generally speaking, being practice ready is something they would like more from students coming out of law school. There are good reasons for that. But Foundations for Practice showed us that you can look at the competencies, at the specific concrete skills and abilities. And if you gauged a candidate for employment based on those things, I mean, you're more likely to get a new lawyer who can hit the ground running. But what the profession is just as guilty as the academy in being wedded to tradition. I think all too often we're relying on these prestige factors as proxies for quality. there's evidence to suggest that some of those prestige factors do directly connect to things like, you know, maybe intelligence. But on the other hand, they're not a perfect measure of all this other array of skills and abilities that students might be developing on their own before they get to law school and in law school. So I think pulling employers away from prestige factors and having them be a little more critical about what they're looking for and how they're looking for it, that would be a great influence on the whole system too. So the responsibility is shared both by the profession and the academy. And then finally, you know, regulators are a big part of this. We are in the midst of great change. I keep bringing it up, but, you know, access to justice is a big issue here, but so is licensure. I mean, what we're seeing is states like Oregon and Utah are finding alternatives to the bar exam. And that's all part of this. We need to test you based on whether or not you have skills. Your acquired knowledge, your ability to recall, memorize things, is that really a sign that you're going to be a good lawyer? When I was at IELTS, we issued the Building a Better Bar report, which challenged the validity of the bar exam. Validity being, you know, does the bar test or does the exam test what it purports to test? And in some ways it does, and in many ways it does exactly the opposite. Would it ever be a sign of competence if you as a lawyer simply relied on whatever black law or letter law you memorize without ever being able to look outside of that memorization for updates or changes to the law or anything? I mean, this is what we're testing, and we're not testing applied skills. The bar exam, the next generation bar exam, is changing because of this. It's going to do less of that memorization and more of the applied skills testing. And again, Oregon, Utah, and others are looking at these pathways towards licensure that are more focused on practice, right? And we're kind of returning to, in some ways, what law used to be before the 19th century high cognitive model of legal education, which was apprenticeship, learning by doing.
Yeah, I could remember years ago meeting with a dean of a prestigious law school. He was talking about some of these issues. He asked me what I thought, and I said the first thing I would do would be eliminate the third year of law school and replace it with an apprenticeship opponent. The meeting ended shortly thereafter.
There are systemic problems here, right? Like it's really hard to expect deans to unravel the financial, like the business model that they've inherited and all the financial intricacies that come with that. That's also why, I mean, if I had a call to action, I would really ask your audience and our profession at large to just get more involved to help, because no one actor can do it. It's a systemic problem.
No, it is. It is. Let's go to a related topic. You've done a lot of work around professional identity and professional identity formation. Talk to us a little bit about that and the importance, what you mean by that and what the importance of it is for prospective lawyers.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, part of this comes from, I'll just jump back into my background a little for your audience to know that I was a lawyer for a while, right? So I practiced law for a while. I ended up working for big law firms doing litigation, and I greatly enjoyed the intellectual challenge of that. I was doing privacy and social media and data breach for a while, and that was all new. You could be creative. But it was a little divorced from my motivation of going to law school, which was advocating, I think, people and helping people, less of the sort of representing the organizations and the businesses. That didn't inherently motivate me.
You were a first-generation law student in your family?
That's exactly right. I was the first in my family, in my immediate family, to go to law school. And the path, it wasn't very clear to me on how to get to where I wanted to go. And so a lot of the system around me, I fell into the incentives, right? So I did well in law school. That led to a summer associateship where I knew I would make a lot of money, which eventually led to my being sort of a corporate litigation attorney. But none of that actually fit who I was or what I was motivated to do. And it didn't really fit with my background very well either. I didn't know that. I didn't understand that mismatch. I didn't understand how to navigate and have agency. And when we talk about professional identity formation, I think that gets to the heart of an experience a lot of students have. It's been labeled as drift, for instance, where you drift away from what it is that authentically motivates you. And part of that leads to a lot of job satisfaction. We have a profession that has a lot of job dissatisfaction. And so professional identity formation helps a student to orient and, again, see their place in the profession, understand what it is that motivates them, how to be there. It's the internalization also of the profession's obligations. What does it mean to be a lawyer? It means client service, but it also means an obligation to the legal system. professional identity formation takes the individual's value, allows them to have agency in that path, but sets up the framework of their obligations for the profession that they're entering. And the other thing that it does really is it provides, I think, an avenue for a lot of the things we talked about at the beginning of this session, which is that those skills and abilities that make for lifelong learning, in order to really gauge your path and to help understand where to direct yourself, there has to be some reflection, and there's socialization and guidance, coaching from others in the profession, an understanding of what it means to be in the profession, seeing what that looks like and experiencing what it could be. So that those sort of those reflective moments, the actual formative experiences, it requires more than just right knowledge acquisition. It requires a whole array of different learning. But the end result, I think, is back to what I mentioned earlier, too, contextualization. And I think a developing lawyer who can contextualize their development is a lawyer who can then more apt to develop practical judgment. So seeing solutions for their clients in a broader context, seeing their role as a lawyer in a broader context, and all within the framework of what the duty and obligations of a lawyer should be. It isn't taught directly in law school. I mean, I think we sort of expect that students get this through osmosis. Professional identity formation and the movement around it is to be more expressed, more deliberate with providing guidance to students.
Okay, so I'm a college student. I'm thinking about going to law school. The professional identity formation concept sounds like a good one to me. What do I do as a practical matter? I go to LSAC and go to Legal Hub? Are there tools? Tell us as a practical matter how I execute on this if I'm a young person thinking about law school.
So put myself in my own shoes, right? When I was an undergraduate student, I didn't know much about what it took to be a lawyer, what resources are out there. There are a variety of resources there. LSAC does have our Law Hub platform, and that's a place where students can go not only to prep for admissions and understand everything that goes into that, but start to understand what does it mean to be a lawyer. And I think students can have an exterior awareness of what all that is beyond what they see on television, the portrayal of lawyers. I think learning about what a lawyer actually does and what it means to be a lawyer, what a day in the life of law school might be, I think helps students to really, again, get that context and determine whether or not they see themselves authentically in that place. And you can do that through Law Hub. I think it's cutting through some of the noise around undergraduate students about what law is or what law should be. Law Hub is also a place where when you're accepted, you can start to build a foundation for what's coming, because legal education, legal writing, the way we think in our doctrinal classes, that analytical thinking, I think it's just a different experience from what students have learned. And so they can go to a place like Law Hub to start to sharpen that and focus. What is it? What are those differences? What do they mean? And my aspiration is to continue to provide resources so that students can see that they've already been on the journey, that a lot of these competencies they've been working on and they may not have known it. And I think that might help students to understand whether or not law is the right profession for them.
What took you to law school to begin with? You touched on this a little bit, but I know you started at Tulane and Katrina came along and gave you a little bit of a break. So you sort of made two decisions to go to law school.
Yeah, I was intent, right? I was intent on it. when I was growing up, my parents were very social. I had appreciation for the people around us. I used to hear a lot of discussions around the dinner table, and I developed a certain empathy for folks. And then I learned when I was in high school that I could be an advocate for people who didn't know how to advocate for themselves. And so for me, being a lawyer was really defending and advocating for people. And then there was a leadership component that seemed necessary to me about being a lawyer, like helping people make decisions, having counsel for people, being both a guide and a defender. So I was highly motivated in my experiences in high school that this seemed like the right path for me. And so I fought to get there. I did go to Tulane. Katrina drove me away. And in that circumstance, I ended up as a clerk intern. I was an evacuee in Little Rock, and the Arkansas Supreme Court carved a position out for me while we were waiting to find out what would happen with law school. So I ended up clerking at the Arkansas Supreme Court before I went to law school, which was especially formative for me. So a lot of my perspective, a lot of what I'm sharing and a lot of the work that I have subsequently dedicated myself to comes from some of those experiences. Justice Annabelle Clinton Nimber used to have me in her chambers, and I would write my attempted analysis, and she would pepper me with questions, and she called it law school. And she was a wonderful model. Her ethics were impeccable. Her ability to reason, her ability to see through the policy implications of things. I just had a much more holistic view of legal analysis and the implications of it. And then I went to William & Mary because at that point I had a little more experience and understanding of what this all meant. And William & Mary, they have a focus on the citizen lawyer, on lawyer as leader, and also this legal skills program, which allows law students to go through simulated kind of law firm experience as they're getting their doctrinal education. So that all pulled me in and kept me moving forward.
It would be inappropriate for me to say there's anything good about Katrina, because there was nothing good about Katrina. But do you think back about the path? You had the opportunity to work with what sounds like an amazing mentor and teacher and justice and got you on the path. It's interesting how these unanticipated events can affect our lives, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is by circumstance. But it was also a lesson in what do you do with the time? What do you do in a moment of crisis when what you've planned for is taken from you? What are you left with? And I don't think I was intentional about this at the time thinking about it, but there were certain competencies that I developed along the line that allowed me to adapt like to a trying circumstances, to see an opportunity to jump into it. But none of that would have been available to me were it not for the empathy, understanding, patience, and generosity of people around me. And that was a lesson too. And so again, with socialization, seeing myself, my opportunities, and how those opportunities really did rely on the good qualities of people around me, that gives me something to aspire to. It gave me something to aspire to as a student, as a lawyer, as a person.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's wonderful. Let's keep going a little bit. You touched on this before. Your work as a corporate lawyer not really fulfilling you, not really being the path you're on. And you move over to IELTS. Why IELTS? What was it about their mission that was interesting to you?
Yeah. So after I'd done litigation for about 5 years and, you know, in litigation, I learned so much about the process, about different lawyers and gamesmanship and efficiency of the court system and the frustrating experience of seeing process get in the way of justice or outcome. And that we all have to do it. I mean, it's good that we have a legal system and it's good that we're thorough, but there are problems and it could be better. I discovered IELTS, which is a policy institute at the University of Denver, founded by a former state Supreme Court justice in Colorado, Justice Rebecca Love Corliss. And its whole mission is dedicated towards improving the civil justice system and reforming it to be a better place for people, for everyday people. And that means helping lawyers, but it also means directly helping people with legal problems. And I saw it and it just spoke to me. I mean, it seemed that was what I had been looking for and that I hadn't found quite yet, and that I could probably exercise a lot of my abilities, my motivations, my energy to help with that mission. And so, so I applied and they agreed, and I started there in 2017.
Sounds like it was a wonderful opportunity for you. You were there until you went over to the LSAC, I take it.
Yeah, that's right. It was. And eventually, as director of legal education in the profession, I was doing a lot of the work that's informed this discussion now on legal education. But the other half of my work was the access to justice issue. And we discovered early on when we tried to help self-represented litigants that there were many barriers to our ability to help people with problems. So, yeah, I mean, half of my work was dedicated to solutions on that problem. And through that work, I've gotten to know and work with a lot of the guests that you've had on this program.
You've co-founded with Natalie. Yeah, that's right.
That's right. So, and you know, and I think ultimately at heart, there are many parallels between the work that I try and do in legal education reform and how we regulate the legal profession and the access to justice issue. There was a study we did at IELTS on self-represented litigants. We wanted to get their perspective. What was the experience like from someone who isn't trained as a lawyer, but had to navigate the process on their own, a very complicated and difficult process at a time, you know, by definition, where their stress levels are going to be high and there are high stakes for them. It's going to affect their life. And we got a lot of really, really great feedback and we got a lot of great perspective on that to help inform our work. But one of the interviews that I'll never forget, and someone basically said, you know, going through this experience was like walking into a pitch black room and you'd ask for help and somebody would shine a pen light in the direction and it would just light up a little tiny piece of that room and then they'd turn it off again. And, you know, it was terrifying. And I always wondered, why can't we just turn on the lights in this room? And that really stuck with me. I think that's true for access to justice. I think that's true in legal education. As a first-generation law student, I had a similar experience. And a lot of my work, I sort of think of it as helping to shine that light and illuminating not only the problems, but the solutions, and then bringing dignity back to the people who are going through these experiences.
That's a wonderful way to wrap up the podcast, Zach. You're doing some fabulous work, and I love the story about the pen light. I'll credit you, but I may use that down the road.
No, please do. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Be sure to visit thepioneerpodcast.com for show notes and more episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.